This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Cat Mug tweeted, "Lots of background coughing in the 1A studio. Very concerned about @JEJohnson322's health." Well, worry not, Cat Mug. I am feeling much better, thank you, despite my lingering cough. The winter has been tough on a lot of us, but the lucky ones, like me, just got a really nasty cold. The unlucky ones, they got the flu.
Offices and hospitals packed as we face a dangerous flu season.
Health officials now say it's one of the worst seasons in a decade.
Even more troubling, this year's flu shot is the same one used in Australia's recent flu season when it was only 10% effective.
7,000 confirmed cases so far. That's double the number this time last year.
According to the Centers for Disease Control, up to 650,000 people worldwide could die from complications of the flu.
That's just some of the reporting from the season, and more than 100 people have died from the flu in the U.S. since the season began in late October. Tens of thousands have been hospitalized. The Centers for Disease Control estimates that the flu kills about 12,000 Americans in a mild year. In a severe year, that number can jump to 56,000. This year marks a century since the global flu pandemic that killed hundreds of millions of people. If another pandemic happened on that scale, would we be ready? Joining us in studio for the hour is Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health. He is the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Dr. Fauci, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Joining us from Minnesota Public Radio is Dr. Michael Osterholm, the director of the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Dr. Osterholm, welcome.
Thank you.
In New Orleans, we have John Berry of Tulane University's School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. He is the author of The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history. John, glad to have you with us.
Thanks. Hello, all.
And also here in studio, Dr. Elizabeth Rosenthal is the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News, and she is the author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We're also happy to have your questions and thoughts about the flu. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Elizabeth Rosenthal, let me start with you. Most basic question, what exactly is the flu, and how is it different from what we would call the common cold?
Well, the flu is a virus. Many colds are caused by viruses, but the flu is a particularly severe one. And people confuse the two a lot. Everyone in my office is going, oh, I had the flu yesterday. And if you're back at work the next day, you most likely didn't have the real flu.
We should play a quick voicemail from the Midwest. We got a lot of great questions from several of you, including this pretty basic one, a lot of basic questions, including this one from our inbox.
Rachel from Cleveland, Ohio. I'm calling about the increase in flus going around. I think that it is very much related to the stress that we're all feeling. Stress.
Rachel, I have no idea about stress. I live in Washington, D.C. There's no stress in this town. But I do take Rachel's question, Dr. Fauci. What do we know about what causes the flu, particularly what causes some years to be worse than others? Stress does affect our immune system. Yeah. Is that part of it?
No. Stress certainly can involve and impact the immune system. But when you're talking about why we're having a bad year this year compared to maybe another year, it has to do with a number of factors. The first is the virus itself. So the predominant virus this year is the H3N2, which is the bad actor among influenzas when you compare it, for example, with influenza H1N1 or influenza B. That's the first thing. The second thing is the nature of the background immunity that people have from experiences in previous year. If you have a virus that's a bit different than what we've seen in a previous year, it could be a bad year. And then it depends on the match of the vaccine. If you have a bad match to the vaccine, that can be a diminution in the protection that the vaccine can get. You put all those three factors together, and that's why you have a particular type of a season.
When we talk about H1N1, these different designations, Dr. Fauci. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, there are proteins on the surface of the influenza virus called hemagglutinin, and they're different types of hemagglutinin. So, for example, the viruses that affect humans are fundamentally the H3N2, H1N1. In 1957, we had an H2N2. That just means a different type of a hemagglutinin molecule.
So when we create a flu vaccine, that's what the vaccine is aiming for those kinds of proteins.
Exactly. The major target of the immune response to protect you is against the hemagglutinin. And you get protection against other proteins on the virus, such as neuraminidase and a number of others. But the main one, the main target is the H or the hemagglutinin.
Another voicemail we would like to play, also incidentally from the state of Ohio. Here's that message from our inbox.
This is Jessica Moss, and I'm 34 years old, and I live in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I just came back from the clinic where I was diagnosed with the flu for the first time in my adult life. I just started getting the flu shot a couple of years ago, and the doctor told me that if I hadn't had the flu shot, it would be a lot worse than it is right now. Turns out that this year's flu isn't like previous year's flu. There were 10 other people in line behind me, and everybody had the flu.
Thanks very much for calling in with that, Elizabeth. Incidentally, we should note nearly 4,000 Ohioans have been hospitalized from the flu this season, so hopefully Jessica's getting a lot of rest and taking care of herself. How have the last flu seasons been compared to years before?
Well, again, you know, you first want to wonder if 10 people are at a clinic and all have gotten the flu or been told by a physician they have the flu, whether they really have the real flu. But beyond that, this is a moderate to severe flu season. They vary tremendously depending on the factors that Dr. Fauci mentioned. And I think what people have to understand about the flu vaccine is it's not like some of the vaccines we traditionally think of, the chickenpox or the measles, mumps, rubella, which are really, really effective. The flu vaccine at best will reduce your chances of getting the flu, often by a lot. It will make the flu less severe if you get it. So having gotten the flu vaccine, you don't want to feel scammed because, hey, wait, I got the flu. It isn't 100% effective.
We are talking about the past, present, and future of the flu with Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health, Dr. Michael Osterholm of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, John Barry, the author of The Great Influenza, Elizabeth Rosenthal, the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. And from you, what questions do you have about the flu, flu vaccines, about the effort to fight flu, the potential for a pandemic, or for that matter, what have you experienced and encountered with the flu? Did you get your flu shot? Why? Why not? And what are you noticing where you are as it relates to both the flu and how people are dealing with the flu? Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Dr. Michael Osterholm, let me come to you. Generally speaking, are flu seasons getting better, getting worse? Maybe that's too broad a term, because we should clarify what we mean by better or worse in terms of infections or treatments or deaths, but how do you view the longer-term trend of flu seasons in terms of whether we're dealing with them better or worse?
Well, first of all, the description of flu we've had so far in the program is very helpful. I would just add one additional piece. You know you've had influenza when you feel like you've been hit by a truck. Huh. And that distinguishes it from a lot of the other type of respiratory illnesses. And one of the issues is, well, of course, which strain of the virus is floating out there in any one given year. And that has a lot to do with it. But also it has a lot to do with who you are. And what I mean by that is we know, for example, with H3N2, the current strain that we're worried about most of all, affects primarily the very young and the very old. We see an overabundance of outbreaks right now, for example, in long-term care facilities. On a year where you have H1N1, another strain that is still out there, but some years it's up, some years it's down, you may actually see much more illness in young, healthy adults. And that has to do with how the virus actually interacts with the host. And as we know from influenza pandemics, and John Barry is one of the real experts on this, in 1918, Much of what caused that very serious illness and death was actually likely the immune response of the host, not the virus itself, although the virus specifically set that off. So to say any one year is severe or not, really you have to understand the virus and who's getting it. And I would say this year surely is on track to be one of the most severe seasonal flus we've had in some time. But in 2014-15, we also had a very serious season in terms of number of cases and deaths.
John Barry, I know we have to pause shortly, but I did want you to at least begin telling us about that Spanish flu epidemic of 1918. Can you describe what happened there? And I, from what I've heard, it did not actually start in Spain. That's not why it's called the Spanish flu epidemic. But before we have to pause, could you kind of give us the brief rundown of what that was?
Well, the quick rundown is, of course, the death toll, which is generally the lowest estimate is probably about 35 million, and it goes to about 100 million. Obviously, there weren't very good statistics. That roughly two-thirds of the deaths were probably people between 18 and 45. The deaths were compressed into an incredibly short period of time. Again, about two-thirds of deaths were probably from mid-September to mid-December 1918. Most of the deaths, again, were not just the young adults, but if you look at children, just to give you a sense of impact, deaths among children age 1 to 4, if we had a comparable death toll today, it would equal all-cause deaths for kids 1 to 4 over a 24-year period. So just think about that in terms of psychological impact.
I do want to talk more with you about what we've learned from that 1918 pandemic as it relates to fighting the flu today. When we continue our conversation about the flu, still to come, we will answer more of your questions about flu vaccines, about research for this universal vaccine, and yes, we will discuss this year's flu shot and whether you should get it. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are talking about the flu with Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Michael Osterholm of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, John Barry, the author of The Great Influenza, also of Tulane University, Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News, and with you. We welcome your questions, thoughts, and stories about the flu. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A at WAMU.org. Yesterday, we put out a poll asking how many of you have gotten a flu shot in the past year. 53% of you said you had, 46% of you said you had not, and 1% said, why? I got one last year. Dr. Fauci, it's interesting that 1%, I think, as Elizabeth was mentioning, there's it seems to be one of the most complicated cultural aspects of consumer medicine, the flu shot. Why do you think the flu shot is so confounding for so many people?
Because it's unusual in the field of vaccinology. Usually when you think of vaccines, that measles, you get it when you're 11 to 12 months, and once again when you're 4 to 6 years and you're done. That's not the case with influenza. Influenza, for a variety of reasons, changes, mutates, and drifts from year to year, so that almost invariably you're not dealing with the same influenza this year as you'll deal with next year. So the statement of that 1% then says why I got it last year is incorrect, because the fact is you need to be fully protected to the extent that the vaccine will protect you. And as Elizabeth said, it isn't 100% protective by any means, but nonetheless, the protection you get will be specific for this particular year.
You have dealt with a whole host of infectious diseases over your career. Can you give us some perspective, just kind of in layman's terms, about how tough the flu is to catch from year to year? I mean, in the context of other viral dread diseases, how fast does the flu mutate?
Well, how quickly you could get it and how it mutates is somewhat related but can be different. If you're asking how infective it is a respiratory-borne infection, and it is really quite effective. It isn't, if your example, in the same room, 100%, but it'll be on any given season, anywhere from 10, 15, and sometimes up to 20% of the people will get infected. With regard to its mutation, it readily mutates. Sometimes the mutations have an impact on whether or not the vaccine would work, sometimes not, but it mutates enough to dictate that each year you need to update and upgrade the vaccination.
A number of you are sharing your stories about dealing with the flu this year. Danny wrote on our Facebook page, "My office called in cleaners to wipe down 800 plus cubicles with Virex. This is the first time we've had legitimate flu cases reported in our office. It is spreading like wildfire." Jonathan wrote on our Facebook page that there's no way we are ready for a pandemic. Jonathan commented, "Too many anti-vaxxers second-handedly killing those with compromised immunity." Robert countered, "No one is ever ready for a pandemic, or we would not have pandemics." John Barry, what about that? Could something like the Spanish flu pandemic happen today? We've come a long way in terms of medicine, public health, monitoring, immunology. Could we face the same thing today?
Yeah, absolutely. What dictates what happens is the virus itself. As Dr. Fauci said, the virus mutates from year to year. It's one of the fastest mutating viruses in existence. But a pandemic occurs when a new virus enters the human population. And then you still have some slight cross protection from prior exposures. But basically, you have very, very little natural immune protection. Vaccine will not be developed for months after a pandemic virus appears, and the human population is then very, very vulnerable. So it will spread rapidly. There are pandemics that go about as far back in history as we can look, and generally speaking, you have a minimum of 20%, 30% of the population will be sick.
Dr. Osterholm, what do you think? Is that kind of the crux of why these pandemics are so hard to fight? Because by the time you realize you have a pandemic, that's when the medicine can begin to catch up with it?
And say, I actually think we're much less prepared today for a pandemic than we were in 1918, which may seem somewhat foreign to people.
Less
thinking
prepared
here.
Now?
Yes, because in 1918, we were prepared to deal with nursing care in a way that we're not today, meaning that most of what you're going to be able to provide people even today in a severe worldwide pandemic is going to be largely nursing care. It's not going to be about medicine or vaccines based on what we currently have today. Just take a step back to 2009, which was a relatively mild pandemic when a new H1N1 virus emerged from Mexico. And by the time we actually found the first virus in the very earliest days of the epidemic, then moving to a pandemic, a worldwide epidemic, it was already in at least 27 different countries. So this will move quickly. We will not put some kind of a break in the transmission. It's going to move. The second thing, though, is that if you look at today's vaccines, they're really based on a 1940s technology in terms of how they protect. And so we have real challenges with that. And we also have challenges in terms of how we make them. And in the pandemics of 1957, 68, and 2009, in all three of those, which occurred in the vaccine era, very little vaccine, less than 1% of the world's population were vaccinated in each of those by the time that the pandemic had come and peaked and gone. And we're not much better prepared today on a global basis. So there's this sense that because we have such modern medicine tools available, that somehow will have a big impact on an influenza pandemic. And you can see already what's happening with what is still a relatively moderate, not yet really highly severe influenza seasonal year. We're already seeing major challenges in our healthcare delivery system in terms of running out of drugs, running out of bed space, et cetera. And that's in a world with a lot of modern medicine. So I think we have to be very cautious here about taking a step back and realizing the conditions that will be on the ground when, in fact, another severe influenza pandemic occurs. As John Barry said, it's going to happen.
Elizabeth Rosenthal, to some of Dr. Osterholm's concerns, how well do you think that we are dealing with this flu season?
Well, I think the problem is that the vaccine isn't as effective as we hoped. I want to add a somewhat hopeful note to what we've heard before, which is that what I see in the general public is much, much greater awareness of things like the importance of hand washing, not coming to work when you're sick, how we spread germs. We know people are much, much more aware of that. And we also, you know, for people who do come down with the flu who are very vulnerable, we have much better antiviral medicines that may help mediate a bit the severity of the flu, much more awareness of the secondary infection. So there are some good things which help in the treatment of the flu now. But of course, the main protection is that vaccine world. And we saw the world can respond very quickly. I mean, it was not a flu virus, but we saw the SARS virus in China emerge. And very quickly, once it was understood, people were putting in travel precautions and starting to develop vaccines. So I'm not saying that, you know, we are vulnerable to a pandemic because of the way we do things now, but there are much better technologies and medicines to deal with the flu than there were.
Certainly in terms of the way that we kind of care for one another in the office. Tyra agrees with you on that. She's a hairstylist, and she wrote on our Facebook page, "Two things I cannot stand this time of year: people who cough in their hands and then touch everything in sight and then feel like they did something positive by covering their mouths. You might as well just cough in our faces." And clients who will stay home from work because they're sick, but then will come to their hair appointment. "I've actually told people to go home and reschedule because, like other self-employed people, if I don't work, I don't get paid." Sean tweeted, "Can one of our guests explain why vaccines cannot protect against multiple flu strains?" Dr. Fauci?
Well, the vaccine that one makes, for example, the one we get this year, is directed to protect against an H3N2, an H1N1, and an influenza B. Now, the strain that's put into the vaccine will be the strain that induces a response against that specific virus. Now, unfortunately, for what we've been saying on the program right now, since influenza viruses tend to mutate rather rapidly, you don't have a vaccine that's going to anticipate beforehand how that virus is going to mutate. So if we have a mutation, for example, with a virus that goes on, vaccine that you've made against virus A is not going to protect against virus B, because the immune system is very specific in how it protects against a given thing, which when we get to the discussion later on about a universal flu vaccine, that's the crux of a universal flu vaccine, to have the vaccine induce a response against that part of the virus that doesn't change from strain to strain.
I do want to talk more about that later on, and I know, Dr. Roesterholm, you have a lot of thoughts on that, and I definitely want to hear from you on a universal vaccine. But I wonder, Dr. Fauci, how many strains of the flu are there that we know of?
Okay, well, there are two main groups of influenza A. So if you just want to stick with influenza A for a moment, there are 16 H's and several other N's, namely N is neuraminidase, H is the hemagglutinin. The ones that affect humans are generally restricted. The ones that we see now are H3N2 and H1N1. In 1957, we had H2N2. But there are also influenzas that infect animals, particularly birds, chickens, fowl. For example, right now in China, we have an outbreak among chickens of an H7N9 virus, which predominantly is a chicken virus. But when it jumps to human, which is rare and doesn't effectively go from human to human, it's a pretty lethal virus. So that's an outlier, but it's one we need to keep our eye on, because that's one that could actually mutate to then start spreading efficiently from human to human. And if it does, then we'll be in trouble.
Dr. Roesterholm, I do want to talk to you more about a universal vaccine in a bit, but can you talk to us about the vaccines we have right now? I mean, what is actually in the flu vaccine? How does a flu vaccine work?
Well, first of all, take a step back, and as Tony laid out, among the 18 H types there are, that basically we focus on H1, H2, and H3. And that's the primary piece. And if you want to think of what a flu vaccine, how it's working is, think of that hemagglutinin that we talked about, which is a very important part of the proteins that allow the virus to get into a lung cell. think of it like a broccoli stalk, where the head of the broccoli is what sticks outside of the virus, and the stalk is stuck down inside the virus. The stalk is relatively constant. The head is constantly changing like a kaleidoscope. So if we're trying to find an antibody or a human response to that virus, either from previous infection or being vaccinated, if it can't grab onto that head because it's now different, it's changed, that's what makes it a problem. And I think that one of the challenges we had, and I think anyone who's really honest about their work in flu will tell you that they know less about flu today than they did 10 years ago. Because as we've learned, it was in 2009 when we published a rather controversial paper at the time saying that public health had been grossly overstating the effectiveness of flu vaccines for decades in the 70-90% range, and we found often it was well below 50%. And today, public health struggles to reconcile this message, where years you may have close to zero protection, where some years you may get 50 or 60%. And so one of the challenges we have today is how to use this vaccine, which surely is better than nothing, and I want to emphasize that. But it is clearly inadequate, both in terms of how it protects and the amount of vaccine that can be available in a short period of time. And I think this goes back to a point I want to just emphasize about what Elizabeth said. It's very important to understand, really, the only agents today capable of causing a pandemic, a worldwide epidemic, is really influenza and the emerging issue of antibiotic resistance. SARS, Ebola, they are never going to cause a pandemic. They will cause regional outbreaks that are very important, like we saw with Ebola in Africa or SARS in Asia or MERS in the Middle East. But this is what makes influenza so different and why we have to have a whole new technology that can prepare a world for a pandemic before it emerges, not responding after it emerges. And if, as long as we're responding after it emerges, we're always going to be in very, very deep trouble.
Let me get to a few of your comments and stories. Alice is listening in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Alice writes, I take a flu shot every year, and I got the flu right before Christmas for the first time in 30 years. It hit me like a truck. The doctor stuck a swab up my nose so far it felt like it could go into my brain. Not pleasant, but in 10 minutes she told me I had flu type A. She gave me Tamiflu, as I am 70, and sent me to bed, saying if I felt better, I could go to friends for Christmas if I did not touch anyone or anything. She said she had never seen a holiday season like this. A week later, I got pink eye. I'm now still taking the eye drops for that. Flu lasted a full 10 days. I never want to get it again. Kristen wants to know, how effective is Tamiflu? Our doctor prescribed it for our four kids when one kid got influenza B. I spent $400 only to hear it only shortened symptoms by 12 hours, and it tastes bad. What should people know, Dr. Fauci, about Tamiflu?
Yeah, Tamiflu is a anti-influenza drug that is not in the sense of a curative drug. It, as was just mentioned correctly, it diminishes the duration of symptoms by anywhere from 24 to 48 hours, but it needs, if you want to get maximum efficacy, to be given within 24 hours or so to 48 hours of the initiation of symptoms. What it can do is it can mitigate against the seriousness of an infection. So you may not necessarily get the full duration of illness you can protect against being hospitalized. For example, if a person who takes Tamiflu, they won't essentially get rid of all the symptoms, but it may protect them from getting so sick that they have to go to the hospital. So it's an imperfect drug in the sense that it's not a knockout pill for influenza. It just mitigates some of the symptoms.
Elizabeth, we got an email from Ginger, who's listening. Ginger writes, I've been almost shamelessly wearing a surgical mask on airplanes. Silly?
Well, it's probably not going to protect you against getting the flu, because there are a lot of other places you can get it. You can get it from doorknobs. If people are more comfortable doing so, go ahead. But it's not very good protection. I hope the person who said that also got a flu vaccine, because that's much better protection, even if it's imperfect. And I think what I heard from the first person who wrote in is that I felt like I got hit by a truck. I think the main people who get flu vaccines are people who've had the flu before, and they appreciate how long it can lay you up for, mm-hmm. and how vulnerable you are to those secondary infections, which are what cause the big problems, the pneumonia, the sinusitis, all of that.
Quick question for John before we have to pause. Jules tweeted, I read somewhere that a large majority of the deaths from the huge outbreak, Spanish flu, was actually caused by the excessive use of aspirin. Is that true?
I think that's part of the war effort. We were at war with Germany. Bayer aspirin was well known, and I think there were. It's probably more related to that. No, it would absolutely not have anything to do with aspirin.
James in Freeport, Florida writes, "We the people will never see a complete lifelong immunization against any disease, let alone the flu. Big Pharma makes too much from palliatives and the annual vaccine and other vaccines and palliatives for other diseases and conditions. The great labs will be prohibited from developing any truly universal cure or preventive medication for the flu or for any other infectious disease." We'll talk about the potential for a universal vaccine and Big Pharma's role in a moment. Stay close. Lots of great questions and stories that we'd like to get to in the time we have left to discuss the flu and the possibility of a universal vaccine with Dr. Anthony Fauci, Dr. Michael Osterholm, John Berry, and Elizabeth Rosenthal. Email us 1a@wamu.org. Still time to get in your questions and stories as well. Before we talk about the potential for a universal vaccine, John Berry, can we go back to the 1918 epidemic and the vaccines that came out of that? How did that lead to the first flu vaccine? Did it come immediately? Did it take decades? Well, how did that work?
I mean, they had vaccine technologies back then, but they did not even know what a virus was. In fact, one of the scientific advances that came out of the pandemic was probably realizing that there is a difference between bacteria and a virus. So there was not a direct line to the influenza vaccine. I mean, vaccines had been around before the pandemic. They tried everything they could think of. They actually developed a reasonably effective anti-pneumococcus vaccine, which would be helpful for bacterial pneumonia. They had vaccines against treatments for meningitis and things like that. Probably the most important scientific finding that came out of the pandemic, not probably, very definitely, was it led the straight line, really, to the discovery that DNA carried the genetic code. So, I mean, that was pretty important. But vaccines had been around. Scientists were working on them, and they did gradually figure out how to grow viruses, which was a major problem, and much harder to grow than our bacteria. And just sort of the natural course of scientific development.
All right, let's work our way into the conversation about flu shots, including possibly the one flu shot to rule them all. Here is another voicemail from one of our listeners on the West Coast asking about or sharing her story about a flu shot. Here's what she left in our inbox.
This is Jessica calling from California. I haven't had a flu shot for 16 years. 16 years ago, I got a fever as a result of the flu shot, and then I guess I was exposed to someone who had the flu, so I had the flu for an entire week. Ever since then, I haven't had a flu shot, and I haven't gotten the flu. I try to take at least one tablespoon of apple cider vinegar in hot water every other day, and I'm a chronic hand washer. So that's how I'm not getting sick.
Jessica, thanks for calling in. Dr. Osterholm, what about that? Exposure to the flu, I wonder if Jessica is maybe just taking good general care of her health. I've heard good things about apple cider vinegar. We should all be washing our hands. But the whole thing about being exposed to the flu in the past, from what we've been discussing earlier, it sounds like that's maybe just lucky on Jessica's part, right?
Well, first of all, let me just point out that when we measure how effective a vaccine is, we actually measure it. You get the vaccine or you don't get the vaccine, and then we follow you to find out if you get disease or not. And clearly, the current vaccines provide some protection. Even in a bad year, it may be single-digit protection, but it's surely better than nothing. There is also a growing body of data that says, and somewhat controversial, how much of it the vaccine reduces the severity of illness, particularly in older populations, which may be the case. One thing I wanted to spell here, though, there's been discussion on this program about hand washing. It's, God knows, hand washing is godly in of itself. Our mothers taught us that. But when you actually look very carefully at influenza transmission, very little of it likely occurs from contact with doorknobs or hands and so forth. It's really large droplets or aerosols that occur. And as we have more data on that, it's becoming more apparent. So keep washing your hands. Don't stop. There's a lot of other infectious agents for which that is very important, but it's likely not a big part of influenza prevention. In terms of one of the things that she mentioned is having had influenza before, one of the challenges we now have is it may turn out that in your childhood, those very first exposures you had to influenza virus may have set the entire course for the rest of your life and how you're going to respond to either vaccines or future influenza infections. Because it turns out that those memory cells are created very early in life. And what turns them on or turns them off or doesn't turn them on may actually be only affected in a limited way by subsequent vaccines or illnesses. So this, again, is a very complicated area. And so if you got infected by the right strain at an early age in life, you may actually have some amazing protection that goes for a long time, for which the vaccine will have only a very limited impact on how much it protects you more than what your natural immunity does.
Dr. Osterholm, you mentioned droplets in the air. Bob in St. Louis asked, I read that flu droplets stay in the air for up to 24 hours, even when an infected person is not present. Is that true?
Well, no, but it's still an important point. First of all, let me distinguish. Droplets are kind of like big boulders, invisible boulders that you basically exhale out when you cough or even in some cases breathe. Those basically drop out very quickly, usually within 5 to 6 feet of where they're expelled out. On the other hand, aerosols, which are the really tiny mist, think of it like when you go through a department store and you're three aisles away and you can still smell the perfume department.
Right.
That's an aerosol, where basically it floats in the air. And other agents like measles and so forth are very well known to be transmitted by aerosols. We now have a growing body of data that influenza can also be transmitted that way. In that case, it can go much further than 6 feet, and it may stay in the air for hours, but it's not days.
Dr. Fauci, do flu shots cause the flu? Some people have said that when they get the flu shot, they get sicker than they ever thought they would be when taking a vaccine.
Well, that's the number one myth that the answer to is no, an absolute no. Flu shots do not cause the flu. You can get mild reaction to a flu shot, usually a local reaction. You might feel a little bit achy in some people. But what often happens is that a person gets the flu shot and they've already been exposed to influenza and get influenza right after. I've heard people say, well, I go into the doctor, I get a flu shot, and the next day I get the flu.
Right, I feel like a drug hit me.
That doesn't happen. And also, what co-stimulates in society and in the environment with influenza are other infections that people might misinterpret as the flu. Because right now, what's circulating is two other viruses in addition to influenza. One is respiratory syncytial virus, and the other one is parainfluenza. So someone can get a respiratory illness after they've gotten the flu shot and think it was the flu shot that gave it to them. And in fact, it isn't even the flu. It's another viral respiratory infection.
Mario tweeted, what are your thoughts on the vaccine, especially for infants and toddlers this season? Sam in Ohio also wanted to know about newborns.
Right. No, you don't vaccinate a child until they're 6 months of age. So the recommendation of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is you should vaccinate everyone with few exceptions who are over 6 months of age. Babies do not have a mature enough immune system to be able to make an adequate response.
Dr. Osterholm, Elizabeth, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to add one thing. When people say, oh, I got the flu after the flu shot, what I see so often is people go get the flu shot when everyone in their office starts getting sick. And the flu vaccine takes a few weeks to be fully effective. So that's one of the reasons it's better to get it early and preemptively rather than, oh, everyone in my household is sick, so I'm going to go get a flu shot.
Well, to that point, I wonder, Dr. Osterholm, Michael tweeted, if I haven't gotten the flu shot yet for this year, would it still be effective to get it today?
Yes, absolutely. For what limited protection you may get this year, absolutely. You know, if you're not exposed in the next week or two, you may actually surely have some protection from it. And I think that's an important point. The incubation period for influenza is such that you may actually have picked up the flu going into the doctor's office to get your flu shot because there's so many people with flu in the doctor's offices right now. And so one of the challenges we have is how to get people to a place where you can get vaccinated but not actually be around people who have influenza, which is more likely why you get it 1 or 2 or 3 days after you got the flu shot.
It sounds like the most likely place to get the flu is when you're going to get the flu shot.
Right.
That's right. So you want to make sure that you're trying to go to a well clinic kind of setting rather than going into an emergency room or some kind of urgent care to get a flu shot where there's a lot of people sitting around with influenza.
So it's kind of safer if you just go to your doctor's office?
Right. The best thing to do, it's too late now because we're into January, but the best thing to do is to get your flu shot early before flu hits the community. Then you don't have to worry about what Elizabeth and Michael are talking about.
Glad to hear more of your stories about dealing with the flu. Shishir tweeted, "My wife worked at Build-A-Bear. People would routinely bring kids in who were out sick from school, risking the health of other children. Staff were constantly at risk of getting sick from the worst stuff out there and had to be diligent about hygiene and cleaning." Meg in Carroll County, Maryland wrote, As a child, my grandmother told me stories of her childhood, like when she was 15, living in her Greenwich, Connecticut home, staying in for weeks with the shades drawn. Occasionally, she'd peek out to see a horse-drawn hearse carriage with black ball-fringed curtains going by. This meant yet another neighbor had died. She spoke of trash piling up on the streets as there was a fear of contracting the flu from others' items if collected. John Barry, I wonder if maybe you could respond to that, particularly with regards to how culturally we began to learn to deal not only with the flu, but with our neighbors who were getting sick and who were dying.
Well, I think one of the problems in 1918 was I don't think the war had any impact on the spread of the flu, but it did have an impact on how we responded. Basically because every public health official lied. And they were, the Surgeon General of the United States said, this is ordinary flu by another name. And yet not only was the death toll enormous, but people had horrific symptoms. They could bleed from not only their nose and mouth, but from their eyes and ears. Doctors said they couldn't tell the difference because lack of oxygen turned people so dark they couldn't tell the difference between white and black patients. So people obviously knew this was not ordinary influenza by another name, because they were being lied to because of the disease itself. There was a tremendous amount of fear that spread in the United States. And it got to the point where a guy named Victor Vaughan, who is a very serious, sober scientist, had been dean of the University of Michigan Medical School, said if this continues for a few more weeks, civilization could disappear from the face of the earth. That's how society was breaking down. There were, in fact, in cities, priests were literally driving horse-drawn carts through the streets, telling people to bring out their dead. So there was really a breakdown in society. People starved, mm-hmm. And because their neighbors and even their family wouldn't bring them food. And I think one of the biggest lessons from 1918 is that you need to tell the truth. There were a very few places where, in fact, that did occur, San Francisco being the lead example. And there, society functioned normally, and people behaved heroically because I think they knew what they were facing. When they were lied to, you become alienated.
Right.
Everybody's out for themselves. So unlike most disasters, I'm in New Orleans, certainly in Katrina and other floods, people risk their lives to help other people. And as a general rule, that was not happening in 1918.
Dr. Osterholm, I want to make sure we make time to talk about the universal vaccine before our time is up. I think we've kind of nibbled around the edges of what would have to happen in order for a universal vaccine to work, trying to find a way to get that part of the flu virus that doesn't change from mutation to mutation. I wonder if you could speak to your view of what would have to happen, particularly in light of that comment we read from James earlier, which said, "We the people will never see a complete lifelong immunization against any disease, let alone the flu. Big Pharma makes too much from palliatives in the annual vaccine and other vaccines and palliatives for other diseases and conditions." Doctor?
Yeah, well, thank you. First of all, that statement is absolutely not true. I mean, smallpox eradication from the world is a classic example of that very point. We do want to make vaccines that work. And today we don't need a universal flu vaccine, although that's the terminology that we typically use. So the 18 types of hemagglutinins that we talk about, 1 through 18, if we had a vaccine for H1, 2, 3, 5, 7, and 9, we could take a great deal of the potential for human influenza and pandemics off the table. And so I think that that's the problem. The problem is that there's never been a world prioritization for this. In an op-ed piece that I'd had in the New York Times on Tuesday, I talk about the funding issues for this. While we spend $1 billion a year on HIV vaccines, which I think is a very important investment and wouldn't suggest taking a penny away from that, as a global effort, we spend literally less than $100 million in most years on new vaccines for flu. The WHO has not prioritized it. Even our U.S. government, and Tony, to his credit, has surely brought the NIH front and center on this issue now, but the funding's not there. And so until we actually have a worldwide prioritization where we understand the importance of the coordinated and financial support for this, it's going to keep nibbling along. And I don't think we'll ever see one in my lifetime, but it won't be because of the science necessarily. It'll be because of our lack of political will and resources. And I think that's the challenge we have today. And when you understand what the implications are for a pandemic, let me just tell you, this morning, the EMS drug shortage list is out again for emergency rooms, et cetera. 94 drugs are in short supply or not available today in the United States. And that's just one area, EMS, because we live in a just-in-time delivery system where most of these drugs are made in China and India, and getting them to the United States. We have IV bags that are in short supply today because of the problem in Puerto Rico. A pandemic will have a dramatic impact on the world, like none other that we could imagine. And that's why we need to develop these universal vaccines and get people to use them well in advance of the next pandemic or even the seasonal flu year.
Two last things I'd like to finish with you, Dr. Fauci, before our time is up. One related to the funding question. I wonder what your outlook is in terms of funding for the NIH and going for this kind of universal vaccine.
Well, I made it, as Michael has alluded to, I've made it a top priority for the NIH, at least my institute, the Infectious Disease Institute. So although the funding situation at the NIH is relatively flat over the last several years, we are essentially making it a priority so that when money turns over, we're going to put it into a universal flu vaccine. That's going to be a high priority for sure.
And finally, for people, families, employees, employers who are a little dizzied by all of this still, and they're just wondering, I just want to know if I should get my flu shot.
Yeah.
Should they get the flu shot?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it is not too late. As we've all said on the program, you should get the flu shot. You should get it as soon as you can if you have not been gotten the shot.
That's Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. Dr. Fauci, thanks for talking to us.
Good to be with you.
John Barry of the Tulane University School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine. He is the author of The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history. John, thank you.
Very welcome.
Thank you. Michael Osterholm of the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. Dr. Osterholm, thank you.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Rosenthal, editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News and the author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening, and go wash your hands. This is 1A.